Good afternoon, everyone. This is Jody Manns with the National Academy for State Health Policy. Welcome to today's webinar, Road to Parity, Your Roadside Assistance, being co-hosted by Mercer and Nashby. Please note that your lines will be muted throughout the webinar. However, the chat function is available for you to ask questions of our panelists. Today's session will be recorded, and Nashby will provide the recording and slide deck following the conclusion of the webinar.
Hello, good afternoon, and good morning. My name is Sean Thiel-Sachs, and I'm with Mercer. I've been with Mercer for 4 years and have over 25 years experience in behavioral health, managed care, and government programs. I'm very excited to be here today with our esteemed group of panelists. So very briefly, we'll be hearing from Marjorie Alt. She's one of my Mercer colleagues, who also has over 25 years experience in developing and implementing Medicaid programs and policies, and had worked formerly as a state administrator. We also have joining us Marie Ganim. She is with the health insurance, she is the health insurance commissioner with Rhode Island, and we're excited to have her here. She brings experience addressing the cost of healthcare throughout alternative payment and delivery models as part of the office's reform agenda. Next, we have Nathan Roberts. He is the Medicaid Programs Unit Manager from Oregon Health Authority Health Systems Division, and he has primarily been overseeing the fee-for-service programs and has had a lead role in implementing and overseeing parity within the state of Oregon. And lastly, we have Kelly Weda joining us. She has over 25 years experience in behavioral health systems and is currently the director at the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, and has key roles in overseeing behavioral health Medicaid managed care programs and also leading the way for the Commonwealth in the parity space. So I'm excited to have these wonderful panelists with us. So I'm just going to take a quick moment to give you an overview of what we'll be covering, which you can go to the next slide, please. And then I will hand it over to Kelly to get us started. So as we go through our roadside assistance journey, or our ongoing monitoring and lessons learned to guide mental health parity within our states and Commonwealth, both in the Medicaid and commercial space, we're going to discuss some of the common struggles in both of these areas. We're going to discuss different lessons learned, tips and tools. We also will spend a little bit more time on the non-quantitative treatment limitation analysis, because as you'll hear from our panelists, this is an area that has been a little bit more laborious and tedious. We'll then talk about some of the required changes resulting from the completion of compliance assessments and how the various states and entities have addressed that. And then we'll begin to talk about how do we really move this forward and create systems and structures for monitoring and overseeing ongoing parity compliance across managed care plans. And as I mentioned previously, both in the Medicaid space as well as the commercial space. And then lastly, how you continue to document and demonstrate that compliance through reevaluations and other state or plan requirements going forward. So with that, I'm going to turn it over, if we can go to the next slide, to Kelly Weda from the Pennsylvania Department of Human Services. So Kelly, I will turn it over to you.
Thank you, Sean. Good morning, good afternoon, everybody. Again, my name is Kelly Weda, and I work for the Department of Human Services, the Office of Mental Health and Substance Abuse Services. I'm going to start off with the lessons learned. For us, at the time that we started to do our parity analysis, there were a total of 12 benefit packages. We had 8 physical health managed care organizations, 29 prepaid inpatient health plans, which are our behavioral health managed care organizations that we had through our waiver with CMS, home and community-based waivers through the 1915C, and because most of the mental health and substance use benefits are carved out with the PIPs in Commonwealth, we were responsible as a state to conduct the compliance for MAPIA, the parity compliance. And so what we did, first of all, we developed a cross-agency work group at DHS level that was tasked with oversight and decision-making. And again, this work group was representative of DHS, our Department of Human Services agencies, that were involved in the administration of what we refer to as our Health Choices Program. And this is the Commonwealth's Medicaid Managed Care Program. So you might hear me reference physical health MCOs as well as behavior health MCOs or Health Choices. But again, the Health Choices Program is our state's Medicaid Managed Care Program. I start the process early, obviously, because of all the different complexities of everyone that's involved. After we started having our DHS work group, we also pulled in after that our PIPs as well as our MCOs, developed RFIs to review. We identified over 300 different combinations of managed care organizations and behavioral health managed care organizations, service delivery systems. So you can only begin to imagine how complex this was. So we felt we started early. I just wish we would have started earlier for many of these reasons. And again, we continued to hold regular meetings with everybody throughout the process to keep everyone on the same page. These meetings were held in a work group jointly as well as with individual plans that we utilized Mercer to assist us with. And then I also would like to mention halfway through our analysis, we actually had Community Health Choices join with certain parts of the state. It wasn't a statewide initiative at first, and we're still not there, but Community Health Choices is our MLTSS Health Choices program. So that added another layer that we were working with for that. I also think it's very essential in lessons learned to take the time to define what is going to be captured and how you're going to define the mental health SUD and the medical surgical benefits. We as a Commonwealth decided to adopt the most recent version of the ICD-10 and its standard for defining behavior health SUD and MS benefits. But we had to take time to do that. And then even when we were defining the what would be under inpatient, outpatient, emergency care and prescription drugs in the settings, we kept, you know, after looking at our regulations and policies and bulletins, that took time as well. So I would also recommend just looking at that because it might sound easy, oh, inpatient 24-hour care, but then having to decide what's going to be captured. Inpatient and how you in our final review, inpatient and outpatient utilization, of course, NQTLs was our biggest, as you can imagine, with all of our different combinations. QTLs, we didn't identify any really, so for the NQTLs, the most were inpatient, outpatient utilization, and out-of-network coverage standards were a majority of where ours fell. Some of those were inter-rater reliability across all the MCOs, behavior health managed care organizations, and the community health CHC MCOs. We also saw that there were different definitions. And so as a state, we made contract language changes to define, for example, what emergency admission consisted of, because we wanted to make that consistent across all contracts that we had with our MCOs. Continuity of care, we wanted that to be consistent because we found that wasn't. Or even if we had consistent definitions, our operational definitions, we found that when it came down to the MCOs, whether that be the physical health, the behavioral health, or CHC, that sometimes in their policies, that wasn't consistent, or how it was operationalized at their level wasn't consistent. Approval timeframes, for example, on out-of-network, our single case agreements were not the same across for utilization review. So those are some of the higher level things that we found. And again, we focused on the NQTL and how we're ongoing monitoring of that. And I think if you change to the slide, to the next slide, please. We're doing, what we did and what we're doing to move forward, we have added and revised our contract language, as I stated previously, with our managed care organizations. We've also issued guidance on needed changes. We've done this through policy changes, operational memos, going back with the plans to get a better understanding, because maybe the person at that particular meeting or how they responded to the request for information verbalized wrong or incorrectly what was happening. So we've gone back and done a lot of clarification with the plans. We're also using data as indicators. Some of the things that we are doing with the data and examples are utilization management denials and appeal overturn rates. Mercer is helping us continue to look at those and refresh and get more up-to-date data to make sure that is still under compliance. We've also established small work groups instead of the bigger one with our sister agencies to review any new regulations. We actually have a new regulation what we refer to as IBHS, or Intensive Behavioral Health Services, for services for our children and adolescents. So we had to be cognizant of what was in that regulation and what was being put in, if it was going to cause any parity issues. So anytime a managed care organization wants to change anything, as far as utilization review or what they want to do to cause any limits, maybe they know to contact us and to have it reviewed and get approval before moving forward with anything. We also monitor, have contract monitors, and our contract monitors are aware of to monitor any changes that are happening at the ground level, so to speak, when the rubber hits the road. And review for parity and bring up any of their concerns to the work group to kind of review. And we also keep a good relationship with our contract that we have through Mercer to assist us with these, to be able to provide any kind of technical assistance over what we any kind of questions that we have that we are not aware of. So in a whole, that's what the we're doing here in Pennsylvania. It's ongoing. It's, as you all know, it's not a one and done thing. And it's there's always something new and exciting around the bend. That's all I can say. So with that, I'm going to actually turn it over to Nathan Roberts from Oregon to kind of discuss what's happening in Oregon.
So good morning, everyone. I think I can say good morning because on the West Coast it's still morning. Yes, this is Nathan Roberts from Oregon, and I'll speak a little bit about our experience. So we also, I would say, lesson learned, felt like we didn't start early enough nor put enough resources in at the front end. It is, I think, easy to underestimate how much work and time and how many decisions that, at least for Oregon, we had never thought about in those terms before, had to be made, and so that was a lesson learned for us. Start early and put an adequate number of people on it. In Oregon, we also, like Pennsylvania, found a lot of complexity that because of the way that we are organized. So one thing that was sort of to our advantage in Oregon, I've worked really hard to make all of our Medicaid beneficiaries, the different ways that people are eligible for Medicaid, you know, either through CHIP or straight Medicaid or other ways, or non-pregnant adults, our EPSDP population. We've worked very hard to make all of the benefit packages identical. So that created actually less complexity for us. We didn't have to subdivide out and compare different benefit packages. We are a managed care state, and we do have, at the time we had 16, now we have 15 managed care entities. that are delivering the benefits for 90%, about 90% of the Oregon Medicaid population. And then we also have about 10% of the population that's through fee-for-service. Our plans are comprehensive, so the same plan will do the physical health, the mental health, the dental, the entire benefit package. So at first we thought, oh great, that's going to be really good, but we also have some members that only get a portion of that through the health plan and or through the managed care plan, and another portion of it through the fee-for-service. So it's a smaller number, but some members get, for example, get their physical health through a health plan, through a managed care plan, and their mental health through the fee-for-service program. And that's just for various reasons that that it made sense to do that for those members. So since we did that, then we determined that meant the state would have to be the reporting entity. So we collected up all of the information. We did the comparison from the plan, each plan to itself, on, you know, between physical health and mental health. And then we did a comparison for each plan back to fee-for-service. And we did a comparison of fee-for-service to itself. So that did create quite a bit of complexity for us. We also did have to put in the time to make the determinations about how are we going to define all of these things. How do you define inpatient, outpatient? Which of the programs that we're operating are going to get sorted into which of those categories for mental health analysis purposes? And the same with how are we going to define mental health itself. We also went with the ICD-10 and physical health. We also went with the ICD-10 option, and that made sense for our state. Glad that's behind us. That did take a considerable amount of work. Now that it's behind us, we can just carry forward and won't have to hopefully rethink that too much. So that was nice. We did find that the NQTLs is the area that took the most amount of time for us. We were able to fairly quickly determine that we don't have any QTLs. We don't allow lifetime dollar caps, or we don't have any cost sharing for our members. So there were pretty much all of the QTL things we were able to just make a statement categorically for the entire state that we don't have those or allow those. So that made the parity quick on that part. We did have to take a very deep dive into the NQTLs, as I think most states are finding, most of us are finding, and that data reporting and really helping all of our partners, all of the people that are on point for each of the plans to get this information. It took quite a lot of discussion and webinars and answering questions to get everyone to really understand what it was that we needed to send out and get back from, what information we needed to get back. After a lot of effort, settled on with help from Mercer, who we contracted with, on a templated option. So, I think worked very well for us. So what that means is that every plan and ourselves was reporting in a very strict format, so that we got all the information out and back in the same way, and that made the comparisons more realistically possible to do. So being quite strict about the format of information that was sent out and received turned out to be pretty important for us, I think. And in fact, we will be continuing that in our ongoing monitoring options. So the ask of plans to demonstrate that they continue to be compliant. We'll leverage the same format from the initial analysis pretty heavily to make that a reasonable ask of them. Let's see, what else can I say? So when we did our initial analysis, we did have some findings for our plans and some for ourselves as a state. Most of them were in the outpatient utilization management area, and mostly we found that the level of rigor that plans put on themselves and ourselves as well was greater for the physical health side, and people were less rigorous or looser on the physical health side. So as an example, we found that with one of the state programs that we're running, when the providers are submitting and asking for an authorization on a plan of care, we weren't using qualified mental health professionals, peers, to make those decisions. We were allowing almost like a clerk level decision maker to review and make those decisions, and that wouldn't have been tolerated on the physical health side. That particularly denials needed to be done by a peer, and so we tightened that up, and we found that in most of the plans on the physical health side, the reviewers were held to inter-rater reliability kinds of standards, and not so on the physical health side. So quite a bit around just tightening up or being equally rigorous as far as the quality of reviews on the behavioral health side was something we needed to do. And then we also found in some cases that the expectation of providers who were out of network or out of state was much more onerous. This was more for the plans and for ourselves, much more onerous on the behavioral health side than it was for the physical health side, meaning that in some cases they were requiring full credentialing, and on the behavioral health side, and on the physical health side they would allow a single case agreement that was that didn't require that the provider go through all of the full credentialing steps, so it's less onerous. So we address those issues mainly through directing plans to make changes and making changes ourselves. Our going forward for our new, we happen to be upon a new contract year for our plans. We're on 5-year contracts, so we will start new contracts in 2020, and we have written into and made part of our readiness. Yes, next slide. We have put into our new contracts parity requirements for our plans, and addressing some of the things that we found from the findings, and making our expectations much clearer than they were in the previous contracts. So that is something coming up for us. We will be expecting our plans to demonstrate ongoing compliance. And like I said, we are going to heavily leverage the similar format that we did for the initial analysis, so that should speed it along somewhat. We determined that because all of the plans are starting with new contract requirements, and many of them have new contractors or new subcontractors for various aspects of the work, that we would only be able to do a policy review in 2020, and then from 2021 through the remainder of the 5-year contract, we'll annually do both a policy review, and then have them turn in the numeric analysis so we can look for, are they applying it, you know, their policies equally stringently. So that will be, for example, do they have a good policy around notices of adverse determination? And when you count to the numbers, right, does that also demonstrate that they're applying those policies in a way that has parity? So that is what we're planning to do. We have also recognized and written up some criteria that would trigger an ad hoc parity analysis. So more, you know, maybe we're on our annual schedule, but we might trigger something ad hoc off of the schedule. If, for example, a plan decided to switch their subcontractor for behavior health or something significant or major, or if we stood up a new plan or those kinds of things, those would trigger a parity analysis immediately versus staying on our monitoring schedule. So those are our plans. And I will yield the time.
Thank you. This is Marie Ganim from Rhode Island. I want to start by congratulating Pennsylvania and Oregon for this great work. And not only is the work that both states presented pretty impressive, but I know that other activities going on in those states that is equally as remarkable and really advancing this agenda. So I really want to say congratulations, and we're learning from you. In Rhode Island, we started on this journey looking at parity in our Office of the Health Insurance Commissioner back probably about 4 or 5 years ago, where we started looking at form and rate review. So when the rate applications come in from the commercial insurers, from the fully insured insurers, they file their rate proposals with us every year. They also file all of their forms. So by looking at those forms, we're able really to do a detailed look at what you would call kind of the quantitative end of the parity. And of course, we discovered things like certain exclusions for behavioral health coverage that didn't exist on the MedSurg side. So that activity was going on. And then we decided to launch in 2016 market conduct exams on our four major carriers. And we tried to do a very thorough job of looking at the actual practice, the actual in operation of their policies and procedures. So we took our responsibility and our oversight of benefit determination. So we look at how plans, in fact, make approvals and denials for people to access services. And that law that gives us the authority to do that, along with looking at networks and relationships between providers and insurers, we went out into the field. And that market conduct exam requested actual case records. So randomized case records from the insurers, the four major carriers, that were relative to any benefit determination relative to behavioral health and also to behavioral health medications, pharmaceuticals. So we took those randomly selected cases, and one of the biggest lessons we learned was that that's a ton of work. So if, while it was a very effective way, a very informative way, a very deep dive as to actually in practice how our benefit determinations being made that impact access to behavioral health services that may or may not be the same as the level of benefit determination review that's being conducted in MedSurg. It has taken us years to complete these market conduct exams, partially because of the level of effort it takes a very small staff to go through so many cases. We completed our first market conduct exam about a year ago, finalized it, it's on our website, which our largest major carrier. So that was important to get that one done. But we continue to look for and need state resources, subject matter experts, legal resources to really make certain that we can complete these kinds of case reviews in a timely manner. And I have to underscore legal resources, because once you get to a point where you actually have a report, you've actually reviewed the cases, and you've got some findings, it really does take very strong legal support to work with the carriers to see exactly what the next steps are going to be. One of the other things that we found is when you request case records, you may find case records to be more complete, more thorough from some carriers than for others. So there's also a lot of time spent in asking for further information and then making certain that you can link that information to what it is that you're looking at. We did use some of the federal funds that we had received in our office to actually contract with subject matter experts. So we used some out-of-state psychiatry support to help us with medical necessity determinations and how those decisions were made, and to give us feedback on some of the cases that we were able to push up to them for their level of expertise. So I think what we learned, probably the biggest lesson we learned, was that while we can continue to do ongoing form and rate review every year and kind of keep the quantitative kinds of parity issues really in check, and we can also look at the non-quantitative on paper, review those on paper, but when it comes to looking at practice, it's labor intensive, it's resource intensive. And you just have to be prepared that you're in it for the long haul. Maybe because some other states have ventured in the same direction, and now that Rhode Island has completed at least one, we can learn from each other, and there may be some consultants or some contractors out there now who know how to do this work also. And that may expedite this work going forward. But being one of the first states, again, with Pennsylvania and some other states, doing this work, it was very time-consuming trying to create it. So what we learned was we're going to conduct more targeted market conduct exams in the future. So we're actually right now in the field with one that is very narrowly focused on network adequacy, not only for behavioral health, but across the board. And we are looking at accuracy of provider directories, as well as some geomapping relative to the adequacy of the network. Once that's complete, those two pieces are complete, they're going to bring us to some other conclusions, and then we may do a third one that may focus on other issues associated with networks and the adequacy of networks. But we've learned to be very targeted now in our work. So what did we get out of this? So out of the required compliance. So from our first completed study, that was with Blue Cross Blue Shield of Rhode Island, we are very happy to say that we were able to ask Blue Cross and work with them to in fact decrease, if not discontinue, totally discontinue, the utilization review activity that they were doing on in-network behavioral health providers. So that does two things. So by decreasing or discontinuing, and in general they have discontinued using any kind of benefit determination for in-network behavioral health services, that has both expedited patients getting services, but it has also hopefully lessened some of the burden on providers and perhaps helped our provider network. We're not necessarily, could there be a growth, but hopefully there's some sustenance there of our provider network. So we're pretty happy about that. With all of our studies, we're working on plans of corrections and what those requirements will be in terms of correcting, whether it's training in-house or their own policies and procedures need to be adjusted. We have discovered in the reviews of all of the insurers that there was some prior authorization requirements for medication-assisted treatment where they were very rarely denied. So there were prior authorization processes they would go through, and they would almost always get approved. So we worked with our insurers in a collaborative way to say, let's discontinue for certain medication-assisted treatments, discontinue prior auth, and that has been in place since 2017. In addition to that, we try to encourage in our office integration of behavioral health and primary care, and we've discovered that there are some administrative burdens and challenges to that kind of activity. So we are working again with our insurers, and we have some new regulations that we've just put out on the streets for public comment that would work on things like when is it inappropriate to charge two co-payments for services in the same day. So if someone goes to their primary care provider who has a behavioral health provider on site, and then that patient gets a warm handoff from the primary care provider to the other provider are two copayments really essential in that scenario. So we're little, and there are other coding issues and payment issues that we're working on to try to expedite that kind of care. And then lastly, we've created, our office created with a nonprofit major foundation in our state, a fund for behavioral health prevention. One of the things that we saw in doing these studies, particularly looking at cases, is that we had an inadequate investment in our state in a continuum of behavioral health services, and we also lacked investments in true kind of upstream preventive assistance. So our first insurer, we concluded the market conduct exam with, put $5 million into this fund to kick it off, and we are now working with some of the other insurers and talking about similar investments if that's possible. So that behavioral health fund is active. The first round of grants has gone out, and hopefully it's going to help us have a healthier state, and we'll have hopefully less behavioral health needs if possible. So the next slide, please. Thank you. So as I mentioned, we have plan of correction, which is going to, again, take resources because you've got to work with the insurer on their plan of correction. Does it make sense? Can they, in fact, meet the goals and the schedule? And we, of course, will be monitoring that. The rest of it, I think we have discussed. Just the last piece I'd like to add is that we have a law in our state relative to using criteria, certain criteria called ASAM, for treatment of substance use disorder. And we are currently also looking at the insurers, particularly one, using that criteria in making determinations. So that's what we're doing in Rhode Island. Thank you so much. And now I'd like to turn it over to Sean. Thank you.
Thank you, Marie. As you heard from our panelists, regardless of Medicaid versus commercial, you'll see that there were struggles that are very similar, some lessons learned that I think we can help each other with as a global parity community. So one of the things I want to talk about in the Mercer government space is some of what we've been able to pull together based on our experience across Medicaid, as well as more recent experience internally with our commercial colleagues, and how to create a template approach for consistency. So if you could please go to the next slide. So we've worked, as I mentioned, across several states. I think currently, at least on the Medicaid side, we've done some level of support with approximately 10 states. And what we've found are many common practices, and this was found regardless of whether or not the state had a carve out or if it was integrated with responsibilities solely at the MCO or at the state level. And so what we began to do is pull together these similarities to help create tools and templates for states to have consistent data collection to help minimize ease of burden for those pulling the data together. So we've developed this tool that we call NICE, which stands for MQTL Information Collection Engine, because as you also heard from many of the panels, this was an area that was much more intense. There was sometimes a lot of confusion by plans in particular on the type of data that was needed or the level of detail around information that was needed to do an adequate analysis that was really did not use claims data or other types of data like the financial requirements or quantitative treatment limitation requirements would do. So we pulled together the common practices around the types of NQTLs we saw across the nation, also some of those common processes, associated strategies and evidence within various categories of non-quantitative treatment limitations. And that helped us to then begin to develop one or more options for selection. I will caveat this with saying that there are always those exceptions and there are always those items that might not fit because every state or commonwealth is different based on the benefit packages and the combination of those benefit packages. So we have built an other option to capture any nuances, any differentiations that are not seen over some of the common themes. However, by providing some common choices and examples, that has still created the avenue to help plans and states be able to understand the level of detail that would be needed and the type of information that would be needed for those situations that fall outside of those common themes that we have seen across the country. And the other thing that we're really excited about with our tool, the NICE tool, is that we are able to customize it by state or commonwealth so that it really captures the unique nuances with how the Medicaid system is structured within that state. And finally, what we have found, and I believe Nathan and Kelly both touched on this briefly, is we have been able to, with a templated approach, be able to minimize open-ended questions, help to create some consistency around responses, which has allowed for easier comparisons across delivery systems, benefits, and classifications. And then in those cases where we're no longer part of that initial analysis and we're now looking at changes in the system or a reevaluation of a certain component, we're able to take those templated tools and build off of those so a state or commonwealth is not starting from scratch. So this has really helped at least take, a time-heavy component of the parity analysis and reduce some of the burden. So with that, I would like to have some examples and spend a little bit more time on the kinds of data components we have found that are important for ongoing monitoring and some of the structures and processes in which to do that. So I'm going to go to the next slide and hand this over to Marjorie so she can begin outlining for you in support of this templated approach what kind of data we've seen as important to focus on. So Marjorie?
Thank you, Sean. So much of the preliminary focus of mental health parity has been on that compliance in writing, which you see at the top of the parity triangle. And this is really compliance at that policy level. So you have state oversight entities that have been focused on ensuring that things like the legal requirements support compliance. For state Medicaid managed care programs, that has meant really reviewing the state and MCO contracts, policy guides, and manual requirements to support that parity compliance analysis. These are all things that you can see more easily because they are above the surface, so to speak. But quite frankly, the more difficult task is to ensure parity at that parity compliance in operation, or what lies beneath the surface level. And that's really where the rubber hits the road. Parity in operation is ultimately the determination that the written laws, rules, and policies are actually translating into parity compliant practices for individual coverage and access to the services. This is also where we've been seeing some litigation exposure beginning to emerge across the nation. So parity in operation has proven to be more challenging and really requires that more labor-intensive, deeper dive beyond what exists on paper to understand fully how those limits are operationalized. One of the ways that we can choose to go to look at is in terms of information is identifying parity concerns through complaints from individuals and providers. So from there, we get information like complaints related to provider availability in network, coverage of services, out-of-pocket expenses, provider rates, credentialing and recredentialing requirements. So those are kinds of things that we tend to see through complaints. States can take a step further to support that through member and provider education on parity and creating clear pathways to report parity complaints. And that also helps with the collection of data around where there are problem areas. So in addition to complaint information, what are other ways that we can detect concerns at an operational level in the absence of specific complaints? Two ways we can get at that information are through data and audits, which can be done routinely or an ad hoc basis. So for the routine monitoring, the idea is to use existing or slightly modified data to identify alerts or red flags that signal the potential for a parity concern. Keep in mind that when you're looking at those, they are really only indicators because parity compliance does not require the identical impact of the limit, just that it meets the comparability and stringency test. But those red flag areas can be used to prompt an ad hoc or deeper dive to do sampling of cases that are that more labor intensive level. Next page, please. Here are several examples of key areas that are ripe for using data and reporting to identify those red flags. For Medicaid agencies, you may already be even collecting some of this data. Commercial folks, you can be using that to identify areas of focus or request information as part of your review of managed care organization practices. The trick here is that the data or information that you're collecting needs to be collected and reported in a way that allows the comparison of behavioral health services or providers to the physical health services and providers. While ideally this would align squarely with how you've defined your mental health sub benefits and med-surg benefits, but because these are used as indicators, that level of precision is not required. So you don't have to be clearly aligned with those definitions. These are just indicators of potential red flags or areas of compliance that would be of concern. So a couple of examples, we talked about member complaint data already, provider complaint data. We can look at the timeliness of service authorization decisions for behavioral health services as compared to physical health services. We can look at proportionately, are there higher denial rates for behavioral health services as compared to their physical health counterparts. We can look at readmission rates, higher appeal rates, appeal overturn rates. And we also can look at network adequacy reports to see where there are gaps in network providers, looking at the appointment and access to care standards and utilization of out-of-network providers. These are all rich sources of parity indicators and can be harnessed to be the eyes and ears to detect parity concerns. Next page, please. So as you move forward, we would encourage you to develop an overall monitoring strategy that consists of both those routine and ad hoc mechanisms to do your oversight. The strategy should really address the circumstances and process that trigger the need to conduct a new or supplemental analysis. So we've heard about that a little bit from our speakers today in terms of, you know, are they bringing in new managed care organizations? Are they adding or removing benefits, changing policies, et cetera? So those things might trigger the need to conduct a new or supplemental analysis. And then looking at the routine and ad hoc monitoring mechanisms. Again, as you've heard, this is a labor intensive process, at least at the deep dive level. So you may wanna think about ways that you can use your data and reporting to leverage as that potential indicators, and then identifying what might require the deeper dive. For deep dives, you might want to consider targeting high risk areas such as access to and coverage of medication assisted treatment, development of medical necessity criteria for mental health substance use disorder services, and the use of nationally recognized evidence-based criteria such as ASAM, which was mentioned before. also looking at downgrading or authorizing lower levels of care for mental health substance use disorder in terms of the practices at the plan levels. Additionally, we would recommend that if you're doing the deep dives, you should really develop review tools to help guide the consistency and the validity of the review. And those review tools can address things like the kind of information that will be requested and reviewed, sample sizes, the credentials of the people who are involved in conducting the analysis, including the clinical and operational experts, how you document the findings, the actual criteria that you use to determine parity compliance, and then, of course, ultimately the ultimate parity determination. Next page, please. So in closing, we hope that the information we presented in today's webinar has provided some of our lessons learned and helpful tips in navigating through some of the more challenging aspects of assessing, achieving, and overseeing parity compliance. And with that, we'll take a look and see if we have any questions, and I'll turn that over to Nashby.
All right, any questions should be submitted through the chat function. We'll give it a few minutes. All right, last call for questions through the chat function for any of our panelists. All right, folks, well, thank you for joining us today. Slides and a recording of today's webinar will be provided to all registered participants shortly. Please help us to provide the best content possible to you by taking a brief survey to follow. Thank you again for your time. Happy holidays and enjoy the rest of your day.